Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the University of Iowa's John Papa John Entrepreneurial Center and their National Science Foundation I-Corps Training Program, helping faculty, staff, and students make an impact with their innovations and research. More at iowajpec.org.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today, our political scientists, Jim McCormick of Iowa State University, where he's a professor of political science on the campus of Iowa State University, and Megan Goldberg, assistant professor of American politics at Cornell College in Mount Vernon. Megan and Jim, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much,
Ben. Hi, great to be here.
Want to reach out to our listeners this hour. Join us with your thoughts, your questions for Megan and Jim just days before election day. Your questions, your hopes, your fears, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. So much to get through this hour. I want to ask you in a few minutes about the hundreds, yes, hundreds of court battles over voter rights across the country that may shape these election results. The final campaign stops of the presidential candidates, what they may reveal about the strategies. A look at congressional races. And we ask the question, could the polling we've been seeing for weeks be way off? That yet to come. Let's start off with this. Less than a week left until Election Day. And the early vote has already exceeded half the number of votes that were counted during the entire last election, 2016 presidential election, according to data compiled by the United States Elections Project. As of Tuesday afternoon, nearly 70 million Americans already mailing in their ballots or voting in person. That's over 50% of the total number of votes that were counted during the entire 2016 election. And listen to this. I'm sure you've looked into this, Jim and Megan. Quite astounding. The dramatic numbers in a number of key battleground states. Texas, for example, has received nearly 87% of the votes it counted in all of 2016's election. Florida already more than two-thirds. Iowa on pace for a record turnout. We have about half the votes already received by the county auditors in all of the 2016 election. Jim, what do you see in these heavy turnout numbers?
Well, what I really see is a cheers for democracy, it seems to me. You know, in terms of, you know, the American public generally in presidential elections, I looked at the numbers for the 2016 turnout, and it was 58%. As you mentioned, only about 138 million people voted in that election, and already we've got 70 million. So I think that's sort of the first thing that I would comment on. But secondly, of course, there's been change rules in a number of states. The pandemic has been driving this early voting and using alternative means, whether voting at alternative sites or by the mail-in process. And of course, there's been, certainly in my mailbox, there's been a lot of promotion of getting out to vote. I can't go to a day where I don't get some kind of a promotion element here. So there's really been a whole series of factors, I think, that are driving this.
Mm-hmm. Megan, what do you think this might mean for the tally of results election night?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I think that this, the potential is there. You know, I watched a video from Philadelphia giving a tour of the facility where they count ballots that have come in by mail, and it's very automated, which is like reassuring, I think, for a lot of people in terms of election security and keeping their votes anonymous. But it also, you know, there is the potential that like machines sometimes don't work, right? We've all been using Zoom for 6 months and we know that there are technical difficulties. So this is, you know, there are so many pieces of technology that are relied on to count these votes. And so, you know, if any of those hit a glitch, you have the potential of results being delayed or that there's just so many mail-in ballots. And I know, you know, state officials have been doing and local officials have been doing an awesome job of trying to make sure that they have the capability to process all of these votes. But it's still an astronomical increase in mail-in ballots for a lot of these states that they have to figure out a way to count on Election Day.
Right. And that dovetails nicely into the court action. And this is astounding. I didn't read I knew there were court battles, but I didn't know how many until reading in depth about it this morning. The two major parties have engaged in battles in courts across the country over voter rights. And I'll just reference the New York Times as a trusted news service, quoting their words. In almost every instance, Democrats are trying to make it easier for Americans to cast ballots. Republicans trying to make it harder. Much of the fight involves voting by mail, which many people would prefer to do this year to minimize their risk of contracting the coronavirus at a polling place. Lawyers have already filed more than 300 lawsuits across 44 states over issues related to pandemic voting. The most important cases are in the battleground states. Of course, we've seen those here in Iowa. But for instance, the article New York Times pointing out that in Pennsylvania, the state's highest court has ruled that election officials should count mailed ballots that arrive up to 3 days after the election. Pennsylvania Republicans are trying to get the Supreme Court to reverse that order so that only ballots received by election day will count. Your thoughts, Megan, to you first on this, this myriad of court battles, what that portends.
Yeah, I mean, I think, I think one thing that's really important is that these are really confusing for voters. You know, just anecdotally from conversations that I've had with people who are incredibly smart in Iowa, in Linn County and Johnson County, being confused about what the status of their absentee ballot request is, when they need to return them. And that's despite, I think, really incredible efforts by, some of our local officials here to make sure that we're informed, but it's really hard to keep up with what's happening. So I think that, there's going to be a lot of confusion among voters about what they should be doing to make sure that their vote is counted. And I think that's not great for democracy. Mm-hmm. But I also think that the general pattern there is probably correct, that Republican-led lawsuits are focused on making it harder to vote, and especially that vote by mail. And so I think that, that's a strategy right now for them, and I don't think that the long-term, that that's a good long-term strategy.
Mm-hmm. And we have to say also in the name of, Republicans are saying in the name of voter integrity, right? But that's the
exactly.
case that's being made. Okay. Good. Let's go to our first caller, 1-866-780-9100. Or Jim, did you have something to add on that court action before we go to the phones?
Well, I was just going to mention that it will really slow down the counting process, and it'll be interesting to see to what extent some of these ballots are, backlogged in some of the really battleground states. I think that is really the issue here. And you mentioned Pennsylvania, which is obviously crucial. And now the Republicans are going again to the Supreme Court to try to get, I think it was 3 days after the election that they could send in the ballot and so on.
Yep.
And so if that is done, that and given how crucial Pennsylvania apparently is turning out, maybe it won't be, but at least on the face of it at the moment, that delay in the counting will have a real impact on perhaps the Electoral College outcome.
Right. Pennsylvania, really the state to watch. Florida, the state to watch. Iowa, sure. A battleground state, but Iowa with six electoral votes from our state. Let's go to our phones. Jim is with us from Dubuque. Jim, welcome to a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River with Megan Goldberg and Jim McCormick. What's on your mind?
I'm wondering about there's a big increase in search inquiries by people who want to know if they can change their vote. I know there was a lot of early voting, and with some of the evidence with Bob Alinsky and Hunter's laptop, there's a lot of evidence of corruption mm-hmm. in the Biden family, and there may be people that voted early that want to change their vote. I wonder if pollsters take any of that into account.
Okay, Jim, thank you very much. Jim calling from Dubuque, he mentioned the Biden laptop. I don't know, perhaps Megan or Jim, you can fill us in here if there's any evidence of that. That story fizzled, didn't it, Jim?
Well, there was an interview last night, apparently, on Fox News with Bob Alinsky, in which he, sort of tried to lay it out, his contacts with Hunter Biden, and he claims he had two meetings with Vice President Biden as well. You know, I know there's not been really much coverage of it, but you know, and I think that's what the caller is referring to. On the question of whether you can change your vote, gosh, I suspect that that's really really problematic. I mean, I suppose we could check with if you could go and if you had a mail-in ballot, you could perhaps go and request it at the auditor's office if they would return it to you and make a change. But I think it's pretty hard to to change on that. But I'll defer to Megan on this. She might have some better information.
Megan, any better information? Can you change your vote?
Yeah, you know, I think the only way it would ever be possible is with mail-in ballots. Obviously, in states with just plain early voting where you cast a regular ballot, there would be no way to do that because you can't, because votes are anonymous, you can't go find your ballot. And that's actually, I think, one of the arguments people have made against early voting starting too soon is that it's, you know, that you're voting before sort of everything has come out. Although we also know that, like, October surprises rarely actually shift the election. So, you know, I don't think that it's that possible to change your vote. And so I'm guessing pollsters wouldn't take it into account because you can't change it.
Okay. With all the worries that our counter auditors have, I hope none of them are listening, tearing their hair out at this point. Let's talk about the final campaign stops of our presidential elections. Former President Biden announcing on Monday he would be campaigning here in Iowa, also Georgia. He's been campaigning there in addition to the more traditional end-of-the-race stops, Wisconsin and Florida. Let's listen to a little bit of Joe Biden and in his stop. This is interesting. Campaigning in Warm Springs, Georgia. Historians will know this as a town where Franklin Roosevelt received polio treatments. The former vice president delivered remarks about unity in his campaign speech. Let's listen.
This place, Warm Springs, is a reminder that though broken, each of us can be healed. That as a people and a country, we can overcome this devastating virus. That we can heal a suffering world. And yes, we can restore our soul and save our country.
Okay, juxtapose that with President Trump delivering remarks at a campaign rally near Altoona, Pennsylvania, this on Monday, criticizing the media for their coverage on the COVID-19 surge across the country.
COVID, COVID, COVID. That's all they talk about, the fake news. COVID, COVID, COVID. That's all they talk about, what progress we've made on it, too. We understand it. We know we have to protect our seniors, especially when they have heart, when they have diabetes problems. And we are protecting them. We have the best testing in the world. That's why we show so many cases, because we do more testing than anybody else. But we're doing great. And, excuse me, here I am, right? I'm here too.
Megan, take a first crack at those different approaches to the final days by our presidential candidates.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think the candidates are sort of sticking to the themes of their campaign. You know, none of that sounds particularly new. And that's really what, you know, the last days are for. You know, Trump has sort of changed some of his messaging later in the campaign, which he did in 2016 as well. But for the most part, these last days are just like about reinforcing the message that you've been giving the whole time. So I think, sort of the different tones are not that shocking.
Yeah, but what about this new wrinkle in the president's campaign speech? COVID, COVID, COVID. You know, the fake news media focusing on COVID. We do, in fact, have a pandemic. We do have an average of about 1,000 Americans dying every day. So does that make sense to you, Megan?
I mean, yeah, we do, right? and, you know, I think it's getting more and more common, I think, that you actually, because, right, there are many, many cases, and the pandemic is raging, but there are still people out there who haven't ever met anyone who has had it. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think that for some people that message might resonate, even though you can look at the numbers and see that we are at, you know, in this state, you know, some of the highest case counts we've had, we are record hospitalizations for multiple days in a row.
Right.
But it's still somewhat like rare that you just might not know anyone who has ever had it or had a severe case. So people might, you know, be receptive to that message.
Jim, do you have a different read on this?
Well, I thought that, first of all, in terms of what Vice President Biden said, you know, this has been a theme that he wants to really provide this sense of unity. And, of course, that was that message there with Warm Springs and FDR and so on. But I thought the change here really was with President Trump confronting directly the COVID issue, because what he's done in the past is he's kind of dismissed it, even in some of these rallies. But he's obviously found that he can't, because that, of course, has been the thing that you know, the opposition is beating him over the head with. So he's trying to now, you know, sort of dismiss it seems to me, and sort of be and somewhat cynical about it in terms of the kind of repetitiveness of that COVID is made there. So I took it as a little bit of a change in the kind of the strategy on the part of the Trump administration.
Mm-hmm. Jim, what about this? You were doing political analysis for us during the last election. Megan, you are a newcomer to our state. This will be your first presidential election with us. But Jim, Democrats, of course, when they hear Biden going to Georgia, may have some unpleasant flashbacks to 2016. Hillary Clinton famously investing resources, visiting Arizona in the final days of that race, failing to set foot in what turned out to be key states like Wisconsin.
Yeah, but Georgia, of course, right now, at least, again, if we can trust the polling, it's almost a dead heat within Georgia. And, you know, to pick off one of those southern states, I don't think since 1992 has Georgia voted for a Democrat, and that, you know, 'cause that was Bill Clinton. So it would be obviously a real pickup if Biden can do that. And then Wisconsin, for example, I mean, the lead is much bigger here. And, of course, Wisconsin has been really suffering under the escalation of COVID cases here. So I think that's probably a pretty safe state for Biden at the present time. But you're right. I mean, you can't, you know, sort of neglect, as Hillary Clinton did, you know, some of the instead of accepting that these states are really in your back pocket, you really got to make certain that you, you know, tend to the garden, if you will, here.
Right, right. Megan, do you think so? There must be Democrats out there saying, oh, my gosh, why isn't Biden simply spending the rest of his waking hours until November 3rd living in Pennsylvania?
Yeah, I certainly think there are quite a few people out there scratching their heads. You know, why do you, the races are still close in some of those other states. But I think, you know, even if you sort of imported the 2016 state level polling errors to 2020, that in some of those concerning states that Biden has enough of a lead that suggests he'll win those, even if the polls are as off as they were in 2016, which I'm sure is reassuring to his team. But, you know, I think that it sort of looks like a white whale strategy, like going after those big ones that we've never, you know, Democrats have never been able to lock in is a tempting. It's tempting.
It's spiking the football.
But I think the big difference here, Ben, if I could just jump in.
Go ahead.
Is the turnout. The turnout this year is going to be so much larger than it was in 2016. I mean, one of the things that really, I think, propelled Trump to victory in 2016 is that the turnout, particularly in the, sort of the Midwestern states there, you know, if you look at Wisconsin, I mean, the turnout in, say, Milwaukee County, which would be heavily Democratic, was, even though Clinton won it by a large margin, the turnout was way down. And therefore, you know, the rest of the state, which, and Madison, which is the other sort of Democratic stronghold there, you know, was in the bag, but the rest of the state was really Republican. So I think the turnout actually advantages to a considerable extent Vice President Biden in this race.
Mm-hmm. Let me, before we go to break, let me have you react to an opinion piece that I saw in The Hill. Here's the headline, "Don't Believe the Polls, Trump is Winning." I didn't note the names of those who wrote it, but the Hill, a respectable political source. And just to start off reading a little bit of the article, "We predict that President Trump is going to win the 2020 presidential election and win big. While the majority of polls suggest that Democrat presidential nominee Joe Biden is leading, or at best it's close, those polls suffer from at least three problems." Now, there are a number of problems. I don't know if each of you saw this, but that are pointed out in this article. One of the reasons I've heard before, and the authors of this article say it is a distrust of pollsters also leading to lower response rates for Trump supporters. Jim, could the polling be way off for that and other reasons?
Well, I don't think it would be way off here. I mean, there might be, you know, this kind of silent Trump voter, as they talk about. But, you know, I would estimate that as maybe 2 or 3%, you know, that and maybe that's enough to win some states. I don't dismiss that. But I think that some of this writing about this and in terms of the silent Trump voter is kind of overstated here.
Yep.
So I think that I'm not quite sure that argument that those authors make is wholly convincing.
Mm-hmm. Does it convince you in any way, Megan?
No. I agree. I agree that this argument about secret Trump voters is vastly overstated. And I think that pollsters have also spent the last 4 years trying to figure out how to correct for that, right? Their livelihood depends on them doing this well. And they need that legitimacy to, you know, have people keep paying them to do what they do. And yeah. So they're figuring out how to get around that problem and to have polls be accurate. And to suggest that we should see a huge swing seems unrealistic.
Mm-hmm. Our president's, of course, not elected by popular vote, but by the Electoral College. Whichever candidate wins Iowa's popular vote, for instance, is handed all six of Iowa's electoral votes. 271, the number needed to win. Jim, we don't have much time before we go to break, but what does the latest polling reveal about the paths each candidate has to victory? Joe Biden, according to the polling...
It's very narrow for Trump. I mean, I think the two key states to watch on election night are what happened in North Carolina and Florida early on. I think that'll be a predictor. If Trump cannot win both of those states, I think it really makes it difficult for him to be successful in the Electoral College. For Biden, you know, he has a much wider path, in terms of putting together the needed 270 votes and so on.
Mm-hmm. 30 seconds or 40 seconds for you, Megan, before we go to break on that question.
Yeah, I agree. I think there's quite a few paths for Biden suggested by state polling and not as many paths for Trump. And so I actually agree. I think those states are perhaps the ones to watch. You know, it's always East Coast states because we get their results the soonest. And obviously, you know, there's a lot of talk about Pennsylvania right now. And so I think watching all of those states early on is going to be important.
Okay, we'll be back in just a moment. More from Megan Goldberg, Jim McCormick, Megan from Cornell College, Jim from Iowa State University, our two political scientists on this Politics Wednesday edition of our program. When we come back, I want to have them talk about the possible scenarios for election night and beyond. Also, lessons from the 2000 election. Remember that? Bush and Gore? What are the lessons for the campaigns from that contested election? We may have a contested election this time around. We'll see. We'll be back in just a moment with Megan Goldberg, Jim McCormick, Politics Day. I'm Ben Kiefer. Back in just a moment. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the University of Iowa's John Papa John Entrepreneurial Center and their National Science Foundation I-Corps training program, helping faculty, staff, and students make an impact with their innovations and research. More at iowajpec.org.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Reminder that tomorrow I continue my conversations with Iowa voters, certain groups we've been focusing on in the past several weeks. Tomorrow we focus on farmers and also older Iowans from across the political spectrum. We'll hear their views as the virus surges here in Iowa and other battleground states just days before the election. It's a Politics Wednesday edition today with Megan Goldberg of Cornell College, Jim McCormick of Iowa State University. Before we get to what I promised before the break, lessons possibly from the 2000 contested election that the campaigns are paying attention to today. Let's talk about yesterday morning in a swearing-in ceremony administered by Chief Justice John Roberts. Justice Amy Coney Barrett recited the judicial oath, officially beginning her tenure as the 115th Justice on the Supreme Court. Barrett was confirmed on Monday by a vote by the Senate, 52-48, that vote. Let's hear a couple of voices there. Here's Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and Republicans, of course, celebrating the confirmation of the new justice and dismissing the Democrats' outrage as unfair.
It's a national crisis when a Republican president makes a nominee for the Supreme Court. Catastrophe looms right around the corner. The country will be fundamentally changed forever.
Of course, the Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer and Democrats on Capitol Hill fuming over the confirmation of Justice Coney to the Supreme Court. Let's listen to Schumer.
In contradiction to its stated principles, this Republican majority confirmed a lifetime appointment on the eve of an election. A justice who will alter the lives and freedoms of the American people while they stood in line to vote.
Okay, many, many cases we presume she will be involved with, along with the other justices before the Supreme Court. Let's focus on the election. Megan, how might her vote matter if the election should be contested?
Yeah, I mean, this is, I know we're going to talk about 2000, but right, that's also, you know, a precedent set. So I think that's sort of one of the reasons people think that this was so important to get another conservative justice on the court, was that in case the election somehow ends up in the courts, that it has an impact. But I think where we might see an effect is that these cases that are happening now over, if they make it to the Supreme Court, over, you know, ballot deadline extensions, and things like that, that it might have an effect on how ballots are counted before we even really get to, you know, sort of the post-election period, that she could have an influence immediately on those cases.
Mm-hmm. Jim, your view on this confirmation?
Well, one of the things that I watched before the vote was on C-SPAN. I saw the speech both by Minority Leader and the Majority Leader. I mean, and it was really quite stark in terms of the differing views that they had about the role of the Supreme Court here. You know, Senator Schumer was talking about the fact that we didn't know what the issue positions were of this particular nominee, and Senator McConnell talking about, you know, really how you know, the credentials of this candidate were impeccable and so on. And so that, I mean, that's the first thing that I think to think about in terms of this and what the impact might be. In terms of actual outcomes, it seems to me that, you know, I don't think that Associate Justice Coney Barrett will now recuse herself on these cases here. Mm-hmm. But the question is, well, how decisive will she be? Because the really outlier, it seems to me also, is Chief Justice Roberts in terms of what his decision-making would be on some of these cases here. Yeah. And, you know, we saw that going back, and I don't want to preface too much getting back to 2000, but, you know, that kind of split and what happens, you know, in the final kind of outcome. So mm-hmm. I think it's probably less decisive of her particular vote and as well as how it interacts with, say, the Chief Justice here in terms of the outcome.
Well, we're itching to do it, so let's go back 20 years to the 2000 election. Let's have this little audio flashback from CNN's coverage recalling Democrats' nightmare from two decades ago. CNN's coverage of the election night between Democrats Al Gore, Republican George W. Bush. The coverage extended late into the night, Florida being the state too close to call. Let's listen.
A big call to make. CNN announces that we call Florida in the Al Gore column. This is a state both campaigns desperately wanted to win.
Stand by. CNN right now is moving our earlier declaration of Florida back to the too close to call column. George Bush, governor of Texas, will become the 43rd president of the United States at 18 minutes past 2 o'clock Eastern time.
The vice president has recalled the governor and retracted his concession.
But this race is simply too close to call. And until the results, the recount is concluded and the results of Florida become official, our campaign continues.
Bill Daley, the chairman of the Gore campaign, you just heard it. I think we can hardly believe our ears. He said, until the results are official and certified in the state of Florida, we are going to continue our campaign.
They're still counting, and I'm confident when it's all said and done, we will prevail.
And folks, in the year 2004, please, could you make up your minds a little more conclusively? Because I think we can't take another election like this one.
Okay, what a piece of history there. With Judy Woodruff and others reporting on CNN in that bit of archive from 20 years ago. Jim, I'm sure you remember that evening clearly, the networks mistakenly calling Florida and the race for Al Gore, then later in the night moving it to the toss-up category, so many steps, eventually George W. Bush winning, as decided by the U.S. Supreme Court. What are the lessons for the campaigns from that contested 2000 election?
Well, I think one of the lessons is, of course, that they want to make certain that they have, you know, monitors in the vote counting system. I mean, that was one of the issues there in terms of the hanging chads and so on. And I think it was the result was, and you might correct me on this, that Bush was declared the winner with 534 votes, more votes. I think that was the number. It was 500 plus. So it was a very, very close call here. So I think that's sort of the first lesson here. The second lesson is already being taken up by the campaigns because, as you probably have noted, both the Biden campaign and the Trump campaign have engaged a whole series of lawyers to get ready if there's a contestation over voting in particular states here. So I suppose that's the other sort of kind of negative lesson that comes out of this this experience.
Yeah. Megan, your thoughts?
Yeah, you know, I think that one of the big lessons from 2000, right, is that perception really matters from election night. So, you know, I think I wasn't super old in 2000, young enough that my parents made me go to bed at some point. But Gore conceding early on when he didn't really have to made a big impact on sort of like the legitimacy of him pursuing this later on. And so I think that's one lesson that both sides are going to take is like, don't concede until it's absolutely necessary. Mm-hmm. And I think the other sort of strategy that Democrats in particular are pursuing right now is to turn out the vote in high enough numbers that the margins of victory are so big that they can withstand these legal challenges, right? So that if the victory isn't so narrow, it's a little harder to challenge them in court.
If you just joined us, Politics Wednesday on this edition of River to River, I'm Ben Kiefer with Megan Goldberg and Jim McCormick, two of our trusted political scientists, Megan from Cornell College, Jim from Iowa State University. Let's go to our callers, 1-866-780-9100. Our fast disappearing, so I'll ask our callers to be quick and concise, but we're sure glad to welcome you to the program. Becky, calling from Iowa City. Welcome.
Hi, Ben.
Hi. What's on your mind?
So what I am afraid about is the fact that we can't seem to agree on what the facts are. And I feel like we used to rely upon scientists and journalists to do the tough work, the diligent process that we counted on to come up with things that we could agree on being as truthful as they could be. And now we are finding that that gets discredited all the time. And meanwhile, people are going onto the internet and mm-hmm. finding things that haven't been vetted at all and are saying that's the truth. And I right. don't see how our democracy can survive.
Yeah, Becky, you've really put your finger on such an important thing. People in getting the news, I mean, generally what you're saying is people getting their news that they agree with, news that doesn't challenge them. That's, of course, not a philosophy of Iowa Public Radio or public television. But Megan, talk a little bit about that. Our media environment has changed so much. You can stay in a nice, comfortable spot where your views get reinforced by the internet, by the social media, whatever, right?
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, there's some evidence that this idea of like sort of an echo chamber is slightly exaggerated, especially when it comes to your sort of regular media consumption, that most people actually consume quite a bit of different media. That's maybe mm-hmm. not quite the same as like social media. But I think, you know, sort of bringing this back to the election, you know, we know from past elections that the networks often follow each other. We don't get a ton of, there might be timing differences, but we don't get a ton of disagreement where one state or one network says a state went one way and another network says a state went a different way. And sort of that's what I'm sort of curious to see this year, is if we still see that sort of unanimous agreement among networks. That's where I think in terms of, you know, accepting the results of the election, because those immediate perceptions are not based on certified vote. It's based on networks calling it.
And we have to
so
believe
that's
that
going to be interesting.
Right. And then we have to believe the networks will be extremely cautious in calling, especially this election, given what's happened before and given the charges against the mainstream media that by the president, that this is there's something untoward happening with the mainstream media. Let's go to Tom, caller. Thanks for waiting, Tom. What's your question or thought?
Well, I was responding to the last half hour's discussion of all the fear mongering that's going on about whether the results will be posted on election night. I think in Iowa, we can, for the most part, appreciate that the results will be posted. The auditor here in Polk County assures me that whether I vote in person or by mail, that those votes will be counted on election day. So I think the laws here are amenable to doing that, whereas in other states it might not be the case. But I think Iowans can rest assured that their votes, I mean, I don't want, after the Iowa caucuses, anything can happen, but, and after the pandemic, anything can happen as well. Things are really surging in this state, and who knows what's going to happen by Election Day. But I think, for the most part, we can be assured that all of the votes, almost all, will be counted by election night.
Okay, yes, that's the read that I have, Tom, too, Jim, that's what you're getting to. I mean, here in Iowa, we are voters in Iowa. We are living in Iowa. You have confidence in our voting. Secretary of State Paul Pate, I've been to the website. I've looked at my ballot has arrived. Perhaps you too, Jim.
Absolutely. It has arrived, and I've completed it and so on. And I do have confidence. I'm glad that the caller, made that statement because I think, you know, that is a nice reinforcement, certainly what I believe. And you know, Iowa has always been, I think, governed in a sort of clean and open, transparent sort of way. And so I don't have any qualms that there will be any kind of problems in terms of counting the outcome within Iowa here.
Okay, let's go to another caller, Harley. Harley is in Des Moines. Harley, running out of time. Glad to have you with us. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I just want to know, crazy worst-case scenario, let's say all it's done, it's validated, Trump loses, he refuses to leave office.
Okay.
What would it, and that sounds crazy, but it's 2020, so I'm just curious what would happen.
Yeah, really, exactly, Harley. It's 2020. Almost nothing is out of bounds when you say, what if? Thanks for the question. Megan, what are your thoughts on that question? It's been batted around quite a bit in recent weeks.
Yeah, I think the most realistic scenario is that if it seems like Trump has lost, that we'll have protracted legal battles, that it won't be this clean cut, you know, he just refuses to leave office. But, you know, I'm going to be totally frank. One of the things about studying American politics for so long is that I'm not actually sure. we have this tradition of peaceful transfers of power, and, you know, I hope that if it's the case that it's clear that Trump has lost, that he has, that there are enough people left in his administration. You know, I know everyone has been asked, will you commit to a peaceful transfer of power? Will you commit? Will you commit? And I hope that there's some people there who, will give him the right advice
because,
what we value in American politics.
Right, and you're saying the right advice because the president himself has struggled when asked about this, the peaceful transition of power, has struggled to come up with what has been the right answer for nearly 250 years, Jim, right?
Yes, I agree with Megan here. I think that, you know, some of the advisors, and I think that probably members of Congress and particularly the Senate, the Republican senators, would turn to the president, and say, you know, if he has any hesitancy about not accepting the results. And that, I think, would be a very strong kind of impetus for him to yield. I think we have a lesson here from 2000. You may remember after the Supreme Court decision, there was this great picture on television that I remember seeing of Gore and Bush talking to one another and congratulating one another.
Yep.
And I hope, you know, if we have a kind of a stalemate or a close election like that, and it's contested and there's an outcome, that will be the model that will be followed by these two participants.
Mm-hmm. Before we say goodbye for the day, let's take a quick dive into the congressional races. Your thoughts on that? The Democrats need a pickup of 3 seats to control the Senate if they win the White House as well. Megan, your thoughts on Senate races, perhaps in particular the Ernst Greenfield race, seen as a possible flip to Democrats here in Iowa. Thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I think it's interesting here that Greenfield seems to be running a little bit ahead of Biden, I think, in the last poll. So I think that's interesting. But yeah, I think all I can say is, I've been getting a lot of mail about that particular race. And
right.
So I think there's a lot of eyes on Iowa right now. In terms
so
of
you're seeing polling. You're seeing polling that shows Greenfield polling better against her opponent than Biden is against his opponent.
Yes.
Mm. Okay, Jim, what are you seeing?
Well, it's a very close sort of toss-up race, but I mean, Greenfield, at least in the polling, has really been ahead here, and Ernst has been running behind Trump in Iowa as well, very slightly here, and I don't know if that's a sort of an indicator, and maybe it's reflecting of how Greenfield is running stronger than Biden as well. But I think it's going to be very difficult for the Republicans to maintain control of the Senate, given the races. I've sort of been looking over the races again this morning here, the hurdle for the Democrats is you know, as you mentioned, 3 seats. If they win the presidency, 4 seats. Otherwise, there are so many Republicans that are basically first-term senatorial Republicans that are up. And, of course, those first-term senators are always the most vulnerable. I would not be surprised if there's a flip in the Senate control. Mm.
The U.S. House, quickly on that, 4 House races here in Iowa in the 1st District. The incumbent Finkenauer facing the challenger Republican Hinson in the 2nd, which is an open race. Rita Hart facing Marionette Miller Meeks in the 3rd. Cindy Axne, the incumbent, also a former holder of that seat, David Young, challenging her for a seat that he once held. And for the 4th District, an open seat there, Randy Feenstra, state senator, J.D. Shulton, the Democratic nominee. Megan, we don't have time to go through all of those, but what do you find interesting in the 4 House races? Any discussion that the House is not going to stay in the Democrats' hands?
Yeah, I mean, I would be very surprised if Democrats don't retain control of the House. But I know that the elections in Iowa, especially in the 1st District, are quite close. And we've seen Hinson out fundraise Finkenauer at some points during the race. So, I'm not totally sure what role Iowa will play, but I think Democrats will definitely retain control.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Jim, any final thoughts before we head out here? I know foreign policy is your forte, one of your many fortes, I should say. But foreign policy, we haven't really asked you. There are 2 completely different views of foreign policy and how the U.S. Should act in the world here in this at stake here, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, one is this kind of this America first orientation here, much more nationalistic, populistic kind of approach. And Biden has talked about moving back towards, more kind of a liberal internationalism issue. Be interesting to follow. I'll just make one point about this. You know, the climate accord that President Trump said the United States was withdrawing from, you know, when he gave a 1-year notice, that official withdrawal will occur on November 4th, a day after the election. And so it'll be very interesting to see, you know, if Vice President Biden were to be successful, what he would do about that. I mean, that's one of the things he, as you know from the debate last week, that he talked about in terms of climate change and taking action in that area. And so that would be, I think, kind of a front and center, an issue that, say, if Biden were to assume the White House, that he would confront immediately and perhaps take action on.
Okay, interesting times to say the least. Jim McCormick, Megan Goldberg, so glad that you are here to analyze it with us. Jim McCormick of Iowa State University, Megan Goldberg of Cornell College. Until a future politics day, Megan and Jim, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
River to River, produced by Matt Alvarez, Caitlin Harrop, and Rick Brewer. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for the calls, and thanks for joining us.